Okay, guys, let's get this out of your system now.
Hey, Aubrey, Yoda best.
Hey, Aubrey, you're the Obi-Wan for me.
Hey, Aubrey, I think you're BB great.
Hey, Aubrey, you hold the Wookiee to my heart.
Oh my God. Okay, that's more than enough of that. I'm pretty sure I made it through actual Valentine's Day with less bad puns. Also, I feel it's necessary to mention that The Last Jedi was my first and for sure last Star Wars movie ever. But let's get on with the show.
As you wish. All right, hello all. Today's episode of the forum is another special one. Aubrey and I are joined today by Samantha Innes, former ISGP senior fellow, current student at Drexel University College of Medicine, and our personal go-to for all things medical.
Especially when I'm feeling tempted to diagnose myself with WebMD.
Thank you for the lovely introduction, ladies. I'm excited to be back on the forum today. And hey, did you two realize that the whole topic of today's podcast is Valentine's themed?
No, please no.
Sure it is. Once again, we will be discussing antibiotic resistance and the love of my professional life, genetics. Okay. This podcast is based on a policy position paper entitled Mitigating Antibiotic Resistance with DNA Sequence Information, which was debated at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's Conference on Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases, focused on antimicrobial resistance.
The program was convened by the ISGP in partnership with Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. The paper was authored by Dr. Timothy Paulskill, professor and chair of the Department of Pharmacology at Baylor.
As per protocol, if you will, this paper was presented by Dr. Paulskill and subsequently debated by a number of experts. And if you'd like to continue the conversation and offer your own two cents in the debate, you can communicate with us on Twitter using our handle at ISGPForum or by searching the hashtag ISGPForum.
Or you can find us on Facebook if you search ISGP's The Forum.
And don't forget to subscribe to ISGP's The Forum, wherever you find your podcasts.
All right, where were we? Ah, yes, Mowage. Mowage is what brings us together today.
You know I'm gonna have to ask you to stop it, right?
The marriage between antibiotic resistance mitigation and genetic sequencing. Geez, Aubrey, don't you trust me? Anyway, preventing antibiotic resistance and the process of gene sequencing are a match made in heaven. Maybe. We'll let you decide.
As we've discussed a number of times before, antibiotic resistance is a serious and growing public health concern. Infections caused by methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, aka MRSA, and those associated with multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacteria are increasingly limiting the utility of antibiotics in fighting many, many infections.
And for our biology lesson today, we'll define gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria for you. Gram staining is a way to help visualize bacteria on a microscope and subsequently categorize them based on cell structure. If a bacterium is gram positive, it takes up the stain well due to the nature of its cell wall, which is relatively thick. Staph aureus is an example of a gram positive bacterium. Gram negative bacterium have much thinner cell walls that don't hold the gram stain very well. Additionally, they have a special toxin in their outer membrane that makes them particularly dangerous. An example of a gram-negative bacterium is E. coli.
Among gram-positive organisms, MRSA has become widespread in both hospital and community settings. One 2016 study found that 75% of Staph aureus isolated was resistant to methicillin. But why are we always so concerned about this one bug resistant to this one drug? I mean, really, is this our third episode about it?
Fourth, actually, so far.
Can't we just use penicillin or a similar type of drug?
Actually, we can't. MRSA bacterial strains are resistant to nearly all penicillin-style antibiotics. They're often cross-resistant to other types of antibiotics, such as quinolones, macrolides, aminoglycosides, and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. In med school, we often say that MRSA actually translates to multiply resistant Staph aureus.
I like that. Anyway, the current situation regarding hospital-associated gram-negative infections is equally worrisome. As Sam mentioned earlier, gram-negative bacteria are nasty little bugs with a particularly dangerous toxin, and no new drugs are expected in the near future to effectively treat these infections. Not surprisingly, the presence of multi-drug-resistant strains of gram-negative organisms has been associated with prolonged hospital stays, higher healthcare costs, and increased mortality.
All of this highlights the need for new antibiotics, and particularly ones with novel molecules and unique mechanisms of action within the body. However, unfavorable economic and regulatory environments have reduced the pharmaceutical industry's investments in antibiotic research and development. There are several economic factors involved, but in short, the limited duration of antibiotic use relative to treatments for chronic disease make the former much less profitable.
It's not all doom and gloom, though, because like Wesley the farm boy came for Princess Buttercup, genetics is here to save the day. The rapid emergence of resistance reveals a need for monitoring the spread of antibiotic resistance genes. And according to Dr. Pausko, DNA sequencing is the most rigorous means of tracking the spread of these genes. With thousands of unique resistance genes known, only DNA sequencing can provide the level of detailed genetic information required to reach a precise conclusion about a given resistance mechanism.
And the debaters generally agreed that the future of rapid diagnosis lies with DNA sequencing, which will continue to increase in speed and decrease in cost as the technology progresses. They did note that although the expansion of DNA sequencing as a common tool has great potential, its impact could be limited by the need to produce, store, manage, and then analyze massive amounts of data.
When you say the debaters generally agreed, what do you mean? Many laboratories have already abandoned microbiological culturing, relying on other more advanced tools. Even though sequencing by itself is not quite capable of tracking the spread of disease yet.
And don't you recall the year the CDC was 3 weeks slower than Google in announcing an influenza pandemic? Google was able to analyze popular searches such as symptoms, prescriptions, and other keywords for spikes in requests. And they were able to do it so much faster than traditional observation, culturing, and reporting. It kind of makes you wonder why we even bother with those older methods.
Well, for one, we've already discussed my issues with Googling symptoms, and we know it isn't the most trustworthy form of medical information. I, personally, would definitely know. And two, sequencing is not yet cheap or easy, and is often resisted by institutions of all sizes, which prefer simpler, less expensive options when available. For example, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC Cleo just mentioned, has questioned the need for expansion of sequencing if simpler diagnostics could be effective. The amount of data that comes from DNA sequencing is exceptional, but may be excessive within the current clinical environment.
So we approached our debaters with the age-old question, which is better, the shiny new data-filled way or the slow but familiar way? You know, the classic Team Edward, Team Jacob conundrum.
And just like Bella tried to do, our debaters kind of chose both. A compromise was offered to combine some simpler methodology for international surveillance, such as direct observation of symptoms as a first step, rather than sequencing every pathogen that comes through a clinic. If an epidemic emerges, a move to sequencing more extensively could then be made. This could limit excessive costs, not to mention the amount of data collected.
In short, our debaters believed there will always be a place for traditional observation, reporting, and culturing of bacteria. But that doesn't mean we can't also use sequencing during serious outbreaks. In addition, it was agreed that medicine is not yet at a stage where sequencing every patient's disease sample is even possible, but the technology can work in conjunction with other tools in the immediate future.
Okay, ladies, now picture this. As DNA sequencing technologies continue to improve, sequencing becomes a routine diagnostic tool used to identify bacterial species as well as possible antibiotic resistance mechanisms. This will lead to an opportunity to use DNA sequence information to guide treatment.
As DNA sequencing is incorporated into routine practice, it will greatly increase our understanding of which antibiotic resistance genes or mutations are most common in certain bacteria. It could even help pinpoint the geographical locations most frequently associated with resistant bacterial infections, which would be totally powerful.
On a national and international scale, this would present information on the distribution and abundance of antibiotic resistance genes at any moment in time, as well as dynamic information on how the distributions change over time. The DNA sequence of a cultured bacterium from a patient would provide obvious treatment information because one would be able to avoid prescribing an antibiotic for which resistance genes are already present.
Widespread sequencing and rapid dissemination of the information could also guide treatment when the sequence of an illness-causing organism is not known. In this case, the distribution of resistance genes among bacteria in that geographic region or hospital could be used to predict whether such a resistance gene would be present in the organism at hand.
Information-based targeted therapies could then decrease inappropriate antibiotic use, and thus decrease the spread of antibiotic resistance. It's as simple as that.
Well, as always, it's not quite as simple as that, though. I mean, what we just described is the idealistic Hallmark movie version of this romance. Unfortunately, the real relationship between genetic sequencing and antibiotic resistance mitigation is a lot more like your first high school crush. Really, really confusing. Do we sequence everyone or just some people? Do we have national or international databases? Who's going to pay? And how on earth are we supposed to analyze the crazy amount of information we'd be gathering?
Let's start with what we know. Currently, hospitals in both more and less wealthy countries are beginning to invest in DNA sequencing technologies. And the belief is that DNA sequencing will also inevitably become widespread, even though the timeline for adoption will vary geographically based on available resources.
We also know that our knowledge of the nature and frequency of antibiotic resistance has steadily increased. This is partially because sequencing of large bacterial plasmids and genomes has become routine for research purposes. So now we've got information on the constellation of antibiotic-resistant genes within resistant bacterial isolates, as well as the genetic mechanisms by which these genes can spread to other bacteria.
Simply, there's a great deal of molecular information in the form of gene sequences and mutations that's available to describe and diagnose a resistance mechanism.
We also know that the quality and completeness of a database is crucial to success in using sequence information to guide treatment. Although databases matching DNA sequences with resistance genes do exist, ideally these databases should also contain information on geographic location, like city, state, and hospital, and frequency of the resistance determinant.
But during the debate, questions were raised regarding the incentives for less wealthy countries to contribute to a global database. Many in less wealthy countries feel that the data are primarily being used to help people in wealthier countries. One example was given from Indonesia in 2007, when the health minister held a bacterial sample ransom until assurances granted that treatments generated from the sample would be accessible to those in Indonesia.
It was suggested by the debaters that the quote-unquote global good needs to be the motivating factor here, since every country benefits from an increased understanding of antimicrobial resistance. The database envisioned by the debate table needs to be globally egalitarian, and data need not be limited or censored according to region or individual. But is the global good a sufficient motivator?
That sounds like a great question for the forum's Twitter followers.
Definitely does. Because the information provided by any database is only as good as the information that's submitted, issues regarding quality control were also raised. Poor data quality was acknowledged as a real concern, especially in the early stages of establishing the database when only limited sources will be available.
Now, there are ways to achieve certain quality standards that can be built into the technology, such as requiring a certain number of nucleotides to be sequenced before a sample would be accepted by the system.
However, there are also factors that cannot be controlled at the sample source level. And I think some examples might explain this problem with more clarity. So, for instance, you might imagine a doctor or researcher submitting older samples, for example, rather than newer ones. Or they might choose a patient that seems sicker than another. This could surely lead to pretty significant data biases.
I never would have thought of that. That's actually a great point.
Although it was agreed that the creation of standards for data input and access is critical to make data sharing and utility as efficient as possible, there was some disagreement about how to set these standards.
For example, some debaters argued that no standards would be needed initially, and that data need to be collected without restrictions. This would provide opportunity for standards to emerge rather than government bodies having to act too early and accidentally create inefficient and restrictive regulations.
Conversely, Dr. Paulskill advocated for policies to be developed in advance of participation in data sharing, since all of the information will be deposited into a common international database.
Other debaters agreed that standards for universal formats and data access must be in place before databases are developed. Standardized formatting should be an integral part of creating a useful and universally accessible system. For example, the NIH requires standard file formats and data deposition to receive grants.
Similarly, in my own field, scientific papers are not published unless data, and usually the text itself, are correctly formatted, thereby incentivizing authors to comply with standards.
The Genomics Standards Consortium in the United Kingdom aims to set baseline standards for sequencing data. The goal of the GSC is to promote mechanisms for standardizing the description of genomes, including the exchange and integration of genomic data, so we would even have an existing template to use.
But if Dr. Paulskill was clear on one particular issue, it was definitely this. The construction and operation of the database should be funded by governments, but still be independent of any one government.
The debaters agreed that to secure funding, the proposed international database must emphasize potential national security and global public health benefits. For example, researchers are investigating the use of microbiome data in forensic science, and creating a large microbial database could be useful for such approaches.
They believe that emphasizing national security benefits of microbial DNA sequencing networks may also help to ensure sustained, long-term funding, which is extremely important in a project of this magnitude. Could you imagine spending literal years compiling information to launch this database, learning how to get compliance from data inputters, and all that nonsense, just to have your funding cut off before a project could even reach its full potential? That's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah, I was literally just going to describe that as a nightmare. So back to that whole independence thing, which is really important. The debaters pointed out another good reason to be independent of any one government. And that's the fact that in the future, genomic sequencing data could inform future policy decisions around the world. Currently, many agencies, let alone countries, have different defining criteria and regulatory thresholds. If a global pandemic were to occur, it would be nearly impossible to know whose standards to follow.
Would it be fair or feasible to have the entire world base their policies on the standards of the United States or Japan or Switzerland? Probably not. There needs to be an unbiased, overarching international standard available to guide future legislation.
Additionally, even if genomic sequencing identifies a new potentially dangerous strain, this information on its own may not satisfy current regulatory requirements as a basis on which to make clinical decisions. The rapid diagnostics envisioned may actually be too rapid to fit within the current clinical framework of checks and balances, so the information will be essentially useless.
Which is certainly disheartening. Specific policies targeted at stopping the spread of antibiotic resistance or managing sequencing data were not explicitly stated, but general questions were raised about priorities that governing bodies might want to take into account. Who would police regulations if a sequence database were truly to become a global effort?
Also, should pharmacies have more power to control the distribution of antibiotics? Two more great questions for the Twitterverse.
Definitely.
The issues that still must be addressed are associated with the flood of data that will come with international DNA sequencing, which is a pretty serious concern.
Internationally, less wealthy countries are interested in participating in global sequencing networks, but they're limited not by a lack of DNA sequencing technology like you might expect, but rather by an inability to access and manage the data.
On a more local level, the National Library of Medicine, a division of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, or NIH, has already begun coordinating data obtained from DNA sequencing. Rather than creating a new independent database in the U.S. just for rapid diagnostics, it was suggested that the new DNA sequencing data needs to be integrated into the storage and retrieval system already being developed. No need to reinvent the wheel, or the wheelie complex data system.
Oh, God. Oh my God.
You're kind of the worst today. Just saying. And please promise me that's the last one today. Can you promise me that?
There's no promises.
All right. Despite this option for national data collection, debaters agreed that a new international database and surveillance system would have to be implemented over time. The system should be, quote unquote, smart, and it should present data in an understandable way. It would probably need to be updated in real time as new information is added to the system. Also envisioned are devices and software that even non-specialists could use to interact with the data.
They even went as far as to suggest phones or other mobile devices as a mechanism to provide limited rapid diagnostic capabilities, or apps that track conditions within a certain region, community, or hospital.
According to debaters, making information more useful to physicians, i.e. designing rapid diagnostic tools, needs to be the goal for improved DNA screenings and databases. Currently, only a small percentage of doctors know where to find sequencing information and what to do with it. If you aren't an expert in genetics, nor have one on speed dial, sequencing information is useless to you.
It's more or less agreed that the genomic revolution is already upon us. And although computational challenges will likely be addressed by the continued and often exponential expansion of computing power, establishing an infrastructure that's able to manage the amount and complexity of data is an imminent need.
So, as they say in the newest Star Wars, we should let the past die, kill it if we have to, and move entirely to genetics, baby.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. No. Did you already forget that entire conversation we had at the beginning of today's episode?
Maybe?
The goal is to combine more traditional practices with rapid diagnostics. By combining newer sequencing with older methods of antibiotic testing, there is a better chance of pinpointing types of pathogens and their spread. While sequencing will become invaluable for sure, it will be limited by the information in the database and may, in the end, only be able to determine that, you know, a new organism has been identified.
Efficient use of DNA sequence information and databases requires detailed knowledge of the antibiotic resistance mechanism. Therefore, basic research on the genetics and biochemistry of antibiotic resistance should be continuously supported.
Fine. I guess we can't entirely rely on genetics and genomics just yet. Plus, at some point, they'll be old hat too, and medicine will need to look beyond them by utilizing approaches such as transcriptomics or identifying genes that are expressed by an organism to build more complete data sets, which is so exciting.
Sam, stop with your tangents. Anyway, sure. But the point we're trying to make here is that although DNA diagnostics will be an important tool, traditional tests such as microbiological culturing will remain invaluable to establish a more complete understanding of antibiotic resistance.
Okay. So we need an open source database where clinical microbiology laboratories deposit all sequence information obtained, as well as information on the organism, location, and date.
That's what our debaters suggested, yeah.
And while we are clarifying our debaters' opinions on new versus old, past versus future, we should note that normal, non-pathogenic microbes humans and animals encounter must also be considered. Constant surveillance for new pandemic-level pathogens need not overshadow genetic sequencing of common flora and fauna. Having a wider spectrum of knowledge of the overall microbial environment will provide more information about the origins of resistance.
In conclusion, it was agreed that the goal needs to be a two-part strategy. First, by addressing overall use of antibiotics, and then by coordinating an international surveillance system that integrates and adds data for global use. A perfect pairing to end this Valentine's Day-ish episode.
If you loved this topic and would like to continue the conversation online, join us on Twitter at ISGPForum or by using the hashtag ISGPForum.
You can also like or love this episode as well as articles on other interesting related topics on our Facebook page by searching ISGP's The Forum.
And don't forget to share the love by subscribing to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for joining us today, Sam.
My pleasure.
And as always, thank you to our listeners for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.